Podcast Program.
Welcome to Dreamland, a program dedicated to an examination of areas in the human experience not easily nor neatly put in a box. Things seen at the edge of vision, awakening a part of the mind as yet not mapped, and yet things every bit as real as the air we breathe but don't see. This is Dreamland.
It certainly is. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another Dreamland Sunday evening. I'm Art Bell. My guest shortly is going to be Dr. Carla Turner, published with regard to the human abduction syndrome. A number of books, as a matter of fact, should become to us from Arkansas. First, though, as always, we're going to turn to Linda Moulton Howe, all the way back in Philadelphia. Linda kind of keeps watch on the UFO community, crop circles, animal mutilations, that sort of thing. The whole spectrum, the whole range. And she does so most times from Philadelphia, which is where I believe we're going to find her this evening. Linda, welcome to the program once again.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you know, this summer, one of the stories that I have touched on now two or three times has been the finding of mutilated animals in northern New Mexico. There were, in May, two steers on the Eli Hornich Ranch in Angel Fire, New Mexico, which is east of Taos. And two of those steers were examined by both a veterinarian and pathologist, Dr. John Altshuler in Denver, Colorado, who confirmed that all the excisions of tissue in both of those animals found the same day on May 14th had been cut with high heat. Since then, there have been other mutilated steers found July 24th and August 17th, and now by this weekend, the 13th animal has been found on the same ranch.
Oh, boy.
And tonight I talked with Albuquerque investigator Gail Stalen, who spent this weekend on the ranch, went out to help collect tissue samples for me and for Dr. Altshuler. And right now I want to have our listeners hear her firsthand report, and then I'll give an update on another pathology exam after that. So here we go.
All right, very good. And once again, this is our new sound system.
This pool is laying north of the water towers, I'd say maybe a mile. So we walked to the site. It was by a little pond, and it was laying on its left side. The rectum looked like it had been cored out.
The edges was...
Well, it was kind of, it looked like it had been singed in a way.
Was it darkened and smooth?
Yes, it was darkened. So we went ahead, took samples of that area. We opened up the mouth and noticed that half of the tongue was missing. So we took samples of that.
And how was that cut?
Just in a straight cut.
Vertical?
Yeah, straight across.
And was it very smooth or any?
It was pretty smooth. It didn't look like the buzzards had been on it or anything because the mouth was closed. But the tongue was definitely removed part of it. I would say this bull was maybe 850 pounds. The penis was gone.
And how was that removed?
It looked like it had been cored out also.
Meaning, was it high, deep, or deeper?
Oh, it was deeper. It was deeper than just hide.
Deep. Was it deeper? And like, describe the kind of hole.
I would say it was maybe 8 inches round. And it was just a hole. Just a hole where it had been removed.
And what could you see in the hole, in the cavity of the body?
Well, nothing really. I mean, you could tell that it was gone. You could see part of the rib cage, I guess, was there. Some type of a bone. I know the hip bone was exposed. The buzzards seemed to have been picking at that because it was torn tissue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hide was torn around the hip. That
that appeared to be after these other excisions. after the fact.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And was the, were all the excisions in the rectal area and the penile area, were they dry? Was there fluid?
They were dry. They were pretty well dry. It wasn't real moist until we cut into it.
Mm-hmm.
And the blood inside was a real watery, it looked like real watery down blood.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't real thick.
Okay, and so you were trying to get some lung tissue and some internal tissue.
Right, we were trying to get lung samples. The heart was real mushy.
Was only the heart mushy?
No, there was other, the liver was kind of mushy. But the heart was just, it looked bad. But the lungs were pretty clear. I didn't see any marbling.
Mm-hmm.
In the lungs.
Which may have been, if there had been marbling, it could have suggested pneumonia or something.
Right. We didn't see that, but we went ahead and took samples of it anyway.
And what about the ear and the eye?
Okay, yeah. The ears were intact, the eye was gone, but it looked like buzzards had been picking at it, you know. So I couldn't really tell if the eye was missing due to, you know, anything other than the buzzards. You know.
Now, was this the animal where there was a report from a neighbor of a large black helicopter over the animal?
Not that I know of. I didn't talk to any of the neighbors.
Okay. That must have been.
I had two this week, so I really don't know which one this is because I didn't see the one earlier in the week.
Then it was the one on Wednesday because I talked with Eli about it, and there was
a... Well, this was a Wednesday bull.
Okay, and this was there was a large black helicopter that was seen right over the area.
Right. And a lot of the townspeople have seen it. They've seen this helicopter. They're quite aware of the helicopter activity going on. And they also say, gee, you know, anytime we see the helicopters, we know Eli's going to have another one.
Anything special about this particular helicopter?
I have been told that it's a bell-shaped helicopter. The front end of it is glass. So it's probably an older one.
A bell-shaped helicopter?
Mm-hmm.
How would you explain a bell-shaped helicopter?
Well, that's what the people up there say it is. Two people told me that, that it was a bell shape.
Do they actually hear the sound of the helicopter associated with it?
I asked them and they said yes, that they did hear it.
And then we get back to the question of whether this is something that is government monitoring of frequencies that might be associated with whatever the phenomena is involved with mutilations, or is it something else altogether?
Right. You know, I have no idea. The people are very concerned. Very, very concerned. There's been a lot of media coverage up there. I think they're getting tired of it, but they're concerned. They're glad that we're there to help.
Mm-hmm.
They really appreciate it.
Has anybody in the area ever, in the last month or two or three, reported any unusual, strange moving lights or beams of light in that area?
Eli's ranch hand said that he saw something on the other side of the mountains on the Cimarron side that looked like an orange basketball in the sky.
When was this?
This was back in May, when we went out in May.
Okay. So, that gives you a kind of overview of some of the activity that has been happening as recently as this weekend in northern New Mexico. That orange basketball description was probably one of the most common reports in the 70s when there were so many mutilations throughout the United States and Canada and other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also especially interesting that now we've had two this week, one right after the other, both males, and the July 24th mutilation I talked with Dr. Altshuler about, that was about
3 weeks ago, and he said that he has been able to examine the tissue from that one, and again, he is finding what appears to be the suggestion of high heat. So we are going to try to keep at least building up the case files from a pathology and a veterinarian point of view on these animals that is at least separating them from normal disease and predator.
Sure. Wow. What a story. All right. Linda, as usual, I want to be sure to get your address out to everybody because I know a lot of people in the audience try to and want to communicate with you.
Right. And I really do enjoy seeing these letters because they are giving me a kind of cross-section of what people who are listening to Dreamland around the United States are experiencing in their own lives, not only now, but some of the more interesting letters have been experiences by people going back to the 40s and 50s in which they have never, ever told anyone before. And in some cases, those stories are totally, they appear to be uncontaminated by current literature. So my address, it's Linda Howe, and it's Post Office Box 538. In Huntingdon Valley, Pennsylvania, spelled H-U-N-T-I-N-G, D as in dog, O-N, Valley, Pennsylvania, and the zip code is 19006.
All right. All right. Well, I hope that if anybody has anything, they'll whip it right off to you. And I've got a couple of things headed your way as well, Linda.
All right. And I am trying to make sure that we're covering a lot of waterfronts. I had mentioned last week about Jupiter, and I do intend to do an update. In fact, there was a meeting in Europe this week with one of the scientists from MIT that I'll be interviewing, and I wanted to keep up with the current headlines now, and since they haven't finished this meeting, I think that by next Sunday we should have an even better overview, and I'll still keep trying to update on what happens in northern New Mexico, crop circles, and all these other subjects.
Wonderful. All right, Linda Howe, thank you.
Thank you.
And talk to you next week. That's Linda Howe. I want you to know, received an MA from the University of Nottingham, England, and a PhD in English from the University of North Texas. For over a decade, she taught college English and other professional work, including writing and editing. In 1988, she and her family were forcibly made aware, of alien involvement in their lives. That came after a daytime sighting of a UFO by her husband, Casey, a computer specialist. With the help of Barbara Bartholik, I believe it is, an abduction researcher in Oklahoma, Dr. Turner explored the past and current alien encounters that came to her, including her husband, son, future daughter-in-law, and several close friends. The story of the first year of this investigation is presented in her first book, Into the Fringe, published in 1992 by the Berkeley Publishing Group. Working first with Mrs. Bartholik, and then later, independently, Dr. Turner began to research other abduction cases in her local area of North Central Texas. Since then, the cases have come from many other areas around the country. Her latest research findings are presented in Taken, Inside the Alien-Human Abduction Agenda, published in April of 1994 by Kelt Works, and available exclusively from them by writing to Post Office Box 32, Roland, Arkansas, 72135. In Taken, Dr. Turner presents 8 detailed abduction accounts from women in Texas, Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, New York, and Puerto Rico, as well as an update on the events she and her husband have both experienced. Some of the little-known events discussed include medical, sexual, psychological, and metaphysical procedures. In addition to these alien contacts, several of the women also tell of surveillance, intrusion, even abductions by U.S. military personnel. The correlations of these accounts and the insights gleaned from their experiences make a powerful case for UFO and abduction researchers to expand the recognized parameters of the abduction phenomenon. They further call into serious question most of the theories that have been offered in explanation of this activity. And so now, to all the way to Arkansas, and to Dr. Carla Turner. Dr. Turner, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Art. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you. Hold on just one second. I'm going to put you over here instead. Okay, we've got you over in another place. Dr. Turner, apparently all this began then with an experience you had.
Well, actually, it began with an experience my husband had. As far as our coming to having to deal with this, being aware of ongoing activity that once we begin to investigate, of course, like most people who've had these experiences, we learned that they went back to childhood. But being aware of what they were, that did begin really with a sighting in December of 1987 of a spherical metallic object over the courthouse in the town where we lived that my husband had. There was missing time when he went up on the hill to watch, try to figure out what this object was. He certainly didn't think it was a UFO.
This week's top story.
Like that, because it really wasn't a part of the things we dealt with, thought about, or studied in any way.
How much of a description did he have of the object beyond spherical? In other words, how close was it?
He saw it while he was driving home from the grocery store, and he drove to our house and walked about half a block up a hill. From there, he had a vantage view of downtown where the courthouse was, where this object was, and it was less than 2 miles away, much less, probably. The object was hanging above the courthouse, stationary. There was no movement, no sound. It was not glowing with lights, but it was a burnished metallic color, coppery colored. It seemed to be a total sphere, complete sphere, and it was fairly large, given that it was that close, if it was as close as it appeared to be, which was right over the center of town. And he watched it trying to figure out what the object might be, whether a balloon or even a movie prop. As I mentioned in the book, we lived in an area near Dallas where movies were often made on location. And it really, that was all he thought he was seeing, but he watched it for what he consciously perceived to be less than 10 minutes. And when he turned around to walk back down the hill, because he'd given up on figuring it out, a significant amount of time had apparently passed he hadn't been aware of, and it was almost dark. Whereas it had been quite daylight when he'd gone up the hill.
Wow. So then how much time are we talking about?
Probably 45 minutes or so.
45 minutes?
Yeah, probably. Somewhere around there. Depends on what time. We'd have to go back and look at, you know, measuring the times. We're just guessing because
sure.
It was daylight when he went up there. It was almost dark when he turned around.
So then how did he digest all this?
He didn't. He told me about it. I wasn't with him. He told me about it. He wasn't overly excited. He was curious because he'd never seen anything like it, and he had no explanation. As I said, he didn't even think the word UFO. When he talked about it with me, that never was even mentioned. We assumed it was a movie prop and looked in the newspapers, treated it very ordinarily. But a couple of days later, he did have an unusual event. He found a scabbed over deep incision on the back of his leg, and he got extremely angry about it. For no apparent reason. He didn't know how he got it. It had not been there that he'd been aware of at least very long, because he just found it when it was scabbing and beginning to itch. It's a scab will
sure.
do sometimes.
Sure.
No injury had been inflicted on him that he was aware of, but he did get angry about the cut, and we did not connect the two events. So they're just looking back, you begin to see connections.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we forgot about it at that point, Art.
Well, did he have any desire to, when he began to figure this out, or connect the two and connect the whole experience, did he then want to follow up, maybe get hypnosis, or try and dig into it and figure out what happened?
Yes, but that was several months later. This was in December, right before Christmas of 1987, and as I said, when we didn't see anything in the paper about it, we forgot about it. A day or so later, he found the scar. He did not connect it with the event, and then we forgot all about it, totally. What happened was that we both began to develop intense stress symptoms, physical stress symptoms. And these led us, after they persisted and we couldn't understand why we were both having such physical symptoms, it led us to go into counseling to try to figure out what was wrong.
Sure.
And we each went to separate counselors because we worked in different cities. And my counselor taught me to do self-hypnosis to relax the physical symptoms I was having. His counselor didn't. They simply talked about whatever they could come up with, and after about 3 or 4 sessions, the counselor told him that, frankly, he couldn't find a specific problem for them to work on. He couldn't tell him what the cause of his stress was. And it was at that point that I offered to show him how to do hypnosis so he could relax the symptoms. He was having a number of physical symptoms, including numbness in the leg where he had the cut on the back of his leg, all the way down that entire leg to the foot would have pain and numbness and tingling. He had vision problems, headaches, stomach aches, back problems, just extraordinary number of stress symptoms.
So you decided then you were going to sort of teach him some process of self-hypnosis to try and relieve some of this.
Strictly just what my therapist had taught me, and I had only been to him twice, so it wasn't like I was any adept at it, nor did I explore anything further than just wanting to relax the symptoms I was having.
All right, Dr. Turner, hold on just a moment. We'll come right back to you. We're at the bottom of the hour. This is Dreamland on the CBC Radio Network. I'm Art Bell. And it sounds like there's a lot more of this story and we'll follow up research to hear. Stay right there.
From the Kingdom of Nye, we continue with your calls on Dreamland with Art Bell. Call Art now, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-TALK. First-time callers, area code 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Or the wildcard line at area code 702-727-1295. 727-1295 in the 702 area code. Now again, here's Art Bell.
Now again, here I am. My guest is Dr. Carla Turner here from rural Arkansas. She's published, is the author of In the Fringe and Taken, Inside the Alien Human Abduction Agenda. And we're talking to her about how all this began, which was an experience by her husband. Dr. Turner, you still there? Good. So there was your husband trying to relax himself in the techniques you taught him that had been taught to you. And where do we go from there?
Very simple. He went into a fairly light trance quickly. He was testing himself for the state of the trance, and the only question that he really needed to ask himself when he got there, after he was relaxed, I thought it might be a good idea to do what the therapist had done with me, and that was to ask the subconscious to show you the cause of the stress.
Sure.
And then he mentally asked that question of himself and immediately had a strong, startled physical reaction and had apparently opened up a memory that he had never had any conscious inkling about at all. And he told me in exclamatory tones he saw a face. He described this very unusual face. And then in amazement, he told me he saw this gigantic ship. And I didn't, you know, in the sky, a spacecraft. And he said it was huge. He said the size of a small town. It was this enormous craft. And there were a series of very strange things, including some non-human phone call that we received right when he said that the phone rang. And I got this extraordinarily almost metallic or insectoid-sounding chattering on the other end of the line at me, and then it just went dead. And I brought him out of the trance. I didn't know what had happened. This just was more than we could handle.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
Right.
That's really odd.
And I contacted my therapist the next morning and said, you know, my husband remembered something very strange when he put himself in a trance last night. Would you talk to him? And I told him what he had remembered, and he just sort of scoffed at it and said, I don't know what it was, but I'm sure it wasn't flying saucers and little green men. There aren't any such things. And it was a while. Apparently, we couldn't find anybody. Actually, I contacted several people in the area for help, and when nobody would respond, he went back deliberately into another trance state to see what that was about. He was extremely curious to know what the context was for these memories that he had suddenly had burst through a few nights before. And that's really how it all began. When he went back and looked, he recalled bits and pieces of what seemed to have been an abduction by non-human little creatures when he was only 11 months old on a trip in the car with his father. And he had never remembered this at all, anything about this ever. And his parents came from several states away to visit the next month, and we did have a chance to ask them about the situation as he remembered it without telling them, you know, what he had remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And it was confirmed in a number of ways that, yes, a trip had been made under exactly those circumstances in that area at precisely that time. We pinpointed the day it happened because it was a memorable event, because his father and he were almost 2 hours later returning from a very short errand they were supposed to run for business than they should have been and had no explanation.
All right, this was in 1987, and this kind of launched you into an investigation of the entire phenomenon.
Exactly. It launched us into looking into what had gone on in his past. In the process of the investigation with Barbara Barthwick, I was also questioned about anomalous past events myself and turned up things I had consciously always remembered but had never accounted for in any particular way. And we began looking into things in my past, and then we began having a series of current encounters, intruders, whatever you would like to call it. People vary on how they feel about it, but we certainly felt intruded upon. And this involved my husband and myself and my son, who lived in a different place. He was a graduate student in college. His fiancée and his roommate. And this was an ongoing series of intense events for well over a year before things finally calmed down. And
So this was affecting your entire family? In other words, they were having, and you had experiences?
Yes, I had things that I always remembered consciously, but I didn't know what they meant. And I think you'll find this story from any number of people who, once they wake up to a particular experience that seems to be a trigger. For instance, my husband did recall later under hypnosis what had happened in December of 1987 in the missing time period as he was watching this craft over the center of town. He remembered an abduction occurring. He remembered a series of physical events taking place in a very rushed and hurried atmosphere. And he remembered at one point when this incision was made deep into his leg being told, now you will remember. It is time to remember.
Dr. Turner, if this craft appeared over the center of town, that was the phrase you just used.
That's exactly right, in the daytime.
Then lots and lots of people should have seen it.
Well, one of the things I know now that I certainly didn't know then, after devoting several years of full-time effort to researching the entire subject, one of the things we know are that there are at least two kinds of sightings of craft. And there is one which seems more or less random and open, where many people in an area will spot the craft from different points of vantage points where they are in the area. People along the freeway pulling over and watching crafts. There were flat sightings like that reported intermittently throughout this history. But there are also targeted sightings that target the perceptive ability of only one person or a small group of people in a large area. And this is very common, that even in some case reports we've looked into, there might be a group of people, say five or six, within a 20-foot radius of each other, and a craft appears that only three of those people are able to see.
Oh, boy. So then craft are able to do that, you believe. They're able to be seen by those they want to be seen by and nobody else.
I have no doubt about it. It's not a matter of belief. I think it's proven. Yes.
Proven by what means, Doctor?
By report, as anything in this field is going to be proven, so maybe I should modify the term or at least define how I'm using it. To my satisfaction, I have a very short list of things I consider facts in this phenomenon because they are extremely hard to pin down. Things change, perceptions are distorted, and there's so much deception at the heart of the entire phenomenon, an illusion there, that pinning down any kind of fact is just almost impossible. But I think it's been confirmed to me, at least, by a number of investigated events, that there are targeted sightings in which people are targeted for the sighting and the people with them are not. In fact, I have witnessed a version of this last December. My mother-in-law, my husband, and I were called by some other people in the county where we live now that they had had a sighting of a craft, and it was moving. When it moved away from their area, it moved in our general direction.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out onto the road to an open spot on the top of the mountain ridge where we lived so we could see a great distance, and we watched the craft come in and traverse the horizon less than a mile from us. And we watched it all together, talking about it as we watched it. And when it was gone and we were recapping what we had seen, we each had seen it with different colors doing different types of expressions of color and light.
Oh, boy. Well, that makes collection of data a little more difficult, doesn't it?
Well, that's one of the points I was trying to make in Taken, that just about everything we took for granted has to be questioned in this field. We can't really accept at face value what abductive perceptions honestly report, because they are manipulated to such a great degree.
How much of a mix of the UFO phenomenon do you think there's beginning to be with the metaphysical, Doctor?
Well, I think there's always been a great mix of it. Don't you, if you look back even to the contactee cases?
Well, I do interview after interview with people like yourself, week in and week out,
right.
And I have noticed, Doctor, much more of a movement toward the metaphysical in an attempt to explain all of this.
Yes, I think there's a great deal of motivation toward that point of view, both in the UFO community, factions of the research community promote this view very heavily.
It's very difficult, though, for a hard scientist to swallow it. But nevertheless, people like Dr. Mack, who was with us last week,
uh-huh.
are beginning to move in this direction. And I wonder if there, in other words, as we continue to investigate this entire phenomenon and we want to approach it through the metaphysical, how do we do that?
Well, in just a moment when we have a break, I'll pull out a little statement that I had put together trying to deal with how do we approach this phenomenon, what are our options, and I'll share that with you after our next break. But one thing, we have, whatever one's approach may have been to this phenomenon in the past, there seems to have been such an acceleration of activity in all phases of it since the, I would say 1986 is just a starting point, although that's very vague. There's been such an intense increase in activity, I think it has chipped and hammered away at everyone's preconceptions about this phenomenon.
How long do you think we have been visited on this Earth?
Well, I can give you a personal opinion. I can't give you a statement based on data. Personally, I think it may well have been for centuries, if not more than that.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I jokingly or half-jokingly, talking with another person who's involved in this field a couple of days ago, I said, you know, maybe abductees isn't the correct term really for what we're going through. I said, sometimes it does seem like perhaps everyone has had these experiences and always have. Maybe it's just that something is triggering the species to begin waking up to how to perceive that this is going on, and the waking up process hits individually one at a time, and maybe we're seeing a massive movement toward that.
All right. How are you to know, or how can you be sure, or assure us, that the experiences that you became aware of your own uh-huh. and of your husband's were not part of this great false memory syndrome that everybody's talking about?
Well, it's limited to what one recalls under hypnosis to begin with, and then elaborates thereof, as I understand it. Would you agree with that?
Well, false memory?
Uh-huh.
The
basis of false memory syndrome, as far as I have seen it presented, is that in hypnotic regressions, ideas are implanted and elaborated,
and
thereafter
right. yes.
are counted as real.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, the things in my life that we began looking into, I had always remembered since the time they happened very consciously. There was no hypnosis when I was, for instance, I remembered the first event before I was 6 years old. I remembered it when it happened. I remembered it the next morning. I remembered it thereafter.
What event was that?
Waking up in the middle of the night, or coming to consciousness, I won't say waking up, but coming to awareness, conscious awareness, in the middle of the backyard, in the middle of the night, by myself, as far as my family was not there, and this creature that was very tall and very thin, and in my child way of thinking, I called it a giant grasshopper because it was very insectoid looking, had a hold of my arm and was telling me it was my mother, and I was screaming back at it, no, you're not.
Wow.
I had remembered that since it happened. That was not something that came up out of a hypnosis session. I had never even delved into it with hypnosis.
Did you tell your real mother about that?
Of course. Of course. And they dismissed it, as I guess any parent would.
Bad dream.
As a bad dream.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very much aware of being awake and being in the backyard and this creature being beside me. That, for instance, had always been in my consciousness. Another incident that had happened in the 1970s, driving on a daytime trip on the interstate, in a strange, almost solid-looking black cloud-like object had swept horizontally from beside the interstate onto the road in front of me, stopped right over, covering both lanes, and hovered there, and I thought, you know, trying to make sense of it at 70 miles an hour, what an enormously dense black cloud of smoke, wonder where it came from, hope I don't hit anything when I drive through it.
Sure.
And remember bracing to go through this, and then the next thing I was aware of was seeing it in the rearview mirror behind me, still on the road, and never had any memory of going through it. I've always remembered. These were not things that came up out of hypnosis.
So then your thinking is that everybody or almost everybody may have had these experiences?
I would not rule it out, honestly. And although 6 years ago I would have absolutely denied that was a possibility, I can't deny it's a possibility now. I don't have any way of knowing. It may simply be that we are waking up to something that's been a condition of ours for eons.
Something that's been going on for a long, long time.
Right, we may be coming to a new perceptive, and just for metaphorical terms, a tricameralism of the psyche. We are a bicameral psyche right now in a number of ways. We may be developing a new set of perceptive abilities that will take us to another stage of
Is that some sort of process of evolution, do you think?
Certainly. Either a leap, a mutation, a natural process. You know, when it happens through the generations, there's always one generation at least that's transitional.
Mm-hmm.
If not, you know, more.
If not more. Many believe that the process of evolution is so slow that no single generation could notice a change. But you're suggesting we may be one of those... I'm becoming lost here, but we're a transitional, that's the best way to put it.
That may be. There are other people whose ideas about evolution are that as long, it may well go along slowly for the most part, and then there are unexplained quirky little leaps where it is fairly fast. For instance, the evolution of the Homo sapiens has some quirky little leaps in it that are not explained.
All right, well, you're on a fascinating tangent. Hold on just a moment, and we'll come back to you. Dr. Carla Turner is my guest. Do you think we're in some sort of a transitional... What a fascinating concept. It's a new one. Some sort of transitional change. Fascinating. Never thought about it that way. We'll be right back.
It's not...
Are you there?
Yes, I sure am.
Good. All right, so perhaps we are some sort of transitional generation, and we're all slowly becoming aware of this. That would also, by the way, be validated by the interest in programs like this one, and it is amazing how much interest there is.
Yes, there is. This is part of a lot of people's awareness as they studied this in the last few years. You know, I think I had a real advantage not knowing anything about the entire field or history of ufology when we were thrust right into the middle of it. And having been trained through my academic work to assess and gather data, to analyze trends and historical perspective and context in different areas of activity, I was able to take in rather quickly, through a great deal of work, the history, that at least that was in print, of all the different studies and approaches to this field in a fairly short amount of time, so I was able to get an overview. And one of the things that stood out was this acceleration of change after a certain point in the modern time. There seemed to have been sort of a status quo for centuries. If you look at the work of Jacques Vallée and others who've delved into the legends, the myths, the religious lore, the historical records, in fact, from ages before ours, and see that there were these intermittent accounts that fall within the realm of the UFO phenomena, it was fairly static as far as the acceleration of activity until the modern age. And then we see certain kinds of activity beginning and then beginning massively and then those becoming more and more complex leading up to the massive numbers of people who I believe are telling the honest truth about what they think has happened to them, reporting honestly on events as they've perceived them, and the numbers are staggering.
What do you think all this is headed toward, this increased awareness, even this evolutionary change? What is it headed toward?
Well, again, I'm having to speak from a fairly educated opinion, but certainly no one in this field can claim to have any hard and fast answers from which to work, so we're all making guesses. But I think that if you look at studies that show species societies or groups in intense stress situations go through a metamorphosis, often physically they'll sicken and die. If they don't, they have mental adaptation processes. They get pushed to react and respond in ways they haven't been forced to before simply because there was no need for it. And we may well be going through what is normal as far as evolutionary processes are occurred and just gaining these perceptive abilities that are now allowing us to see interactions and activity of a certain dimensional nature we weren't able to perceive before.
I guess what I was asking is, at some point, do you perceive that there may be a kind of a critical mass of awareness?
I think that's theoretically possible, sure. I think it may be necessary if we're going to really encounter and confront and deal with this situation as we have it right now. Yes, I think most people, you get the feeling most people are asleep to the subject. But if there were, as I see growing in the past several years, numbers of people waking up in different ways, then you begin to think, yes, this could have a critical mass effect.
Mm-hmm. What would that, do you think, result in socially, if somehow we all began to become aware that, oh yes, not only have we been visited for hundreds of years, we're being visited now, it's occurring to many, if not most, people. What?
And it's not a visit.
Yeah.
It's something quite different.
Well, okay, let me take off down that road. What is it?
My best opinion is that it is some form, metaphorically speaking, of farming. That we have a source for certain somethings, qualities of physical materials or energetic energy patterns. I have no idea, although all of those are possible given the data of the abduction report.
Hopefully, we are not as cows are to human beings.
Well, hopefully, but realistically speaking, that's not out of the realm of the data possibility. That if our cows begin to develop, say, self-consciousness, and they begin to perceive their situation more accurately, we would have a big problem on our hands. We would certainly have to change our methods of interacting with the cows. And when we see the changes that have accelerated in the past few years, 10 years, in this phenomenon, you begin to wonder what's made them change from hundreds of years of fairly static procedures.
Would you think that if that was the scenario, that, if you'll excuse the expression, our creators intended for us to be self-aware or not?
I think it may be one of those ironic accidents. And again, I'm theorizing. You're talking theory, I'm going to talk theory back, but I'm not going to talk any theory that goes greatly against the data as I know it. All right?
Well, that's fair enough. All right.
All right.
We are at the top of the hour, so hold your response, if you would, please.
Okay.
We'll be back to Dr. Carla Turner, who's coming to us from rural Arkansas. And we'll talk more about abductions next. This is Dreamland.
Weekday afternoons on Talk Radio 102 are not for the faint-hearted. Not when you've got Gene Burns.
Interested in a fair exchange of ideas and thought-provoking discussion of the events of the day? Then I hope you'll join me, Gene Burns, afternoons here on Talk Radio 102. Every day we open the phone lines and take the pulse of the nation on the news of the day. I think you'll find it stimulating, and I invite you to join in.
Crank it up. Gene Burns, weekdays 2 to 5, right here on Talk Radio 102 FM. The conversation heats up weekdays on Talk Radio 102 FM, the talk station for Central Illinois. Beginning at 10, it's Medicine, Dr. Dina Dell style. Then at 11, Rush Limbaugh, as only Rush can be. Afternoons at 2 belong to Gene Burns. Interesting, stimulating, offbeat, but always the best talk. Get an ear for weekdays. Only on Talk Radio 102 FM. This is Talk Radio 102 FM, WTAZ, Morton, Peoria.
Mutual News. A government newspaper says Cuban President Fidel Castro has decided children and teenagers are too young to decide if they should risk their lives at sea trying to make it to the U.S. so they won't be allowed to take part in the refugee exodus. He's outlasted 8 U.S. presidents, but Secretary of State Warren Christopher says he thinks Castro's days are numbered.
Castro is an example of a failed policy. His economy has failed. It isn't the United States that produced his problem. His problems have been produced the same way problems were produced by communist regimes all over the world. It doesn't work. And and so he's coming to the end of his line. When he will reach that, nobody knows, but he's certainly much nearer that. The economy is in shambles.
Christopher spoke on CBS's Face the Nation. U.S. and Cuban diplomats will be meeting in the next few days to see if they can find any common ground in this flood of refugees. I'm Sam Lutzinger.
So you're the world's greatest football expert.
Ask me anything.
Okay, who had
the... Matt Millen, 1988.
Wow, which one made the...
73 New York Giants.
Okay, what's the only NFL team with Terry Bradshaw, Howie Long, Jimmy Johnson, Pat Summerall, and John Madden?
Never happened.
That's Fox NFL Sunday, the greatest names in football, bringing you great NFL action every week.
Yeah, but that's an all-star take.
Catch the premiere of Fox NFL Sunday, September 4th at noon Eastern, 9 Pacific. Same game, new attitude.
Well, ask me about tennis.
What does love mean?
If you think your carpet is dirty, imagine how dirty a carpet with 40,000 people a day walking on it looks. Hi, I'm David Orrick. We're at International Airport where my 8-pound Orrick XL is the vacuum of choice. In fact, my Orrick XL is the choice of cleaning professionals in thousands of hotels around the world. Try it in your own home absolutely free for 15 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. For a free brochure, 1-800-989-4200.
President Clinton is getting some medical advice from Indiana Congressman Lee Hamilton. Take whatever you can get on health care reform.
I think it's very much in his interest that he would sign a reasonable incremental approach, because after all, it would bring about some improvement in the health care for many Americans, even though it would fall short of his goals.
Hamilton tells NBC's Meet the Press universal coverage may not be possible yet. Electrical workers are still threatening to pull the plug on their labor unless Westinghouse Electric comes up with a new contract they like. Reporter Susan Morris in Pittsburgh says a strike would be very disruptive.
This is going to affect 5,400 workers that are in Buffalo, New York, and in Baltimore, and Virginia, and Western Pennsylvania. It will affect all manufacturing subsidiaries, which make switchgear and electrical components, as well as electrical equipment.
A walkout is now planned for midnight tonight. The sounds of cleanup in Big Flats, Wisconsin. Tornadoes killed 4 people in the state, wrecked buildings, knocked over trees. One couple rode out the storm in their bathtub. U.S. officials are trying to get through the jungles of Peru to reach the site of a plane crash that's left 5 American Drug Enforcement agents missing. And the Drug Enforcement Administration says the chances any of them survived don't look good right now. The lard car has arrived safe and sound in San Francisco after a cross-country drive. The 1984 Chevy van is the creation of 4 women who modified it to run on used French fry oil from fast food.